Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Byron.
How are you today?
I'm good. I am Tim Noah. I am a senior writer with Slate Magazine.
And I am Byron New York, chief political correspondent with the Washington Examiner. And this is the second try we're doing this today because I just cut us off because of the ultra-sensitivity of my iPhone.
And
not
this
that
is,
I'm complaining.
This is a two iPhone con. We are talking to each other iPhone to iPhone. This might be a blocking heads first. I'm not sure.
I doubt that. I feel there's probably a lot of those out there. But this is these are not iPhone 4s, by the way, so hopefully the call will not drop out.
Right. I'm going to hold it any damn way I please and presumably will not cut you off. I have lately become sort of an Apple cultist. I resisted it for years and years and years, and then I...
Oh, really? You didn't actually have them for years?
I didn't have one for years and years. I never was a Mac guy. You know, I worked with... Slate was initially owned by Microsoft, so it
oh,
was...
Oh, yes.
There was no point in getting a Mac because you wouldn't be able to operate any of Slate's operating system platform.
Except that it was better. I guess that was the only reason to...
Right, but you know, I wasn't interested in better. I was interested in how can I do my job best? What machine will let me do my job best? But Slate has since been purchased by the 5 years ago now by the Washington Post Company. It's still actually slightly clumsy to deal with Slate on a Mac, but I did get a Mac. I must say I adore my iPhone. I like my Mac, and I just got my iPad, which I like a lot.
That's right. I got a note from you that said sent from my iPad. So
yeah, you know, I was hearing so much about how this machine is going to be the savior of journalism. I thought, hey, savior of journalism, sign me up.
Okay.
So I'm kind of experimenting with it as a reader, I've gone the whole distance on Apple.
I've used them for years. I got my first one, which was what was called for a while the Mac Classic, which was this thing that stood up. It was kind of a vertical thing and had a very small little black and white screen in it. And I went and bought it at some store, I think in Bethesda or Silver Spring or somewhere, and there were no Apple stores at the time. And I was standing next to a guy as I was paying for the Mac, and he looked over at me and he just said, "Is this your first one?" And
it
I said, "Yeah." And he said, "It'll change your life." I mean, it was like two expectant fathers in the delivery room, you know, and you know, your life is about to change. It'll never be the same. So
this is the context in which Steve Jobs acts like a big baby the first time anybody looks at him sideways. He is used to unconditional worship. And
he is absolutely, and but I have used Macs ever since, and as a matter of fact, if you put me in front of a Windows machine, I will react really badly.
I
think the headline is now it's okay to use Macs at Slate, right? Is that the headline?
It is okay to use Macs at Slate. Yes,
the dark days are over.
The dark days are over, although our operating system is still somewhat inhospitable to them. But yes, and certainly you won't get any dirty looks in the hallways.
Well, the great thing about blogging heads is the viewers, if they want, can just skip over sections. So they may have skipped over this one. But I guess the first thing in the news today is this whole story of Shirley Sherrod, the Department of Agriculture official in Georgia who was summarily dumped by the Obama administration after this video emerged of her in which she first appeared to be saying a number of kind of racially inflammatory things, and then later upon publication of the entire video, the story changed. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts, I was just sort of racing to catch up with the story this morning, actually. I've been crashing on a long-term project. But it seems, I mean, what I'm mostly struck by is the speed and ruthlessness of the news cycle. And now the question, since we're talking technology, the technological question is whether the news cycle is capable of being self-correcting. I don't know, Andrew Breitbart posted this video when? A day or two ago?
Yeah, I think it was the, let's see, I think it was Monday.
And we're talking on Wednesday morning. He posts this thing, and she is immediately dead meat. Shirley Sherrod was this Agriculture Department official, and on the clip she appeared to be saying, you know, this white farmer, well, she did say, literally, this white farmer came to me for help, and he was acting all superior to me, and I, to tell you the truth, wasn't very interested in helping him.
Right.
So I turned him over to someone else at the Agriculture Department who was one of his own kind, who was white, and I thought, he can be that person's problem, not my problem.
Right.
And that's where the clip ends. Mm-hmm. And just on the basis of that, the NAACP condemned her. Of course, you know, the conservative media was all over her. And the Agriculture Secretary, Tom Vilsack, canned her almost immediately. Then word starts to trickle out that this clip did not give a fair representation of her remarks, and the fuller clip was surfaced. And it appears that the spin on this got the whole story exactly backwards, that she was telling this as a kind of a parable, that, you know, so you know, yes, I reacted to this man in a race-based way, and I came to realize that was the wrong way to react to this man. When I passed him over to this white lawyer at the Agriculture Department, this white lawyer didn't really help him. I ended up getting involved again, and I realized this guy was really hurting, and he didn't have any money, and the economically disadvantaged deserve our attention, whether they are black or white, and we are all brothers under the skin. Which is, of course, well, she didn't literally say that, but that was the message, and which is, of course, quite different. And now the news cycle seems to be trying to correct itself, which is. It's sort of interesting. I mean, the question is, can it undo the damage to this poor woman who was misunderstood? Even Glenn Beck has now stepped in and said, this woman really got a raw deal. Breitbart is trying to have it all kinds of ways at the same time, saying it shouldn't be about her, it should be about the applause that her negative comments got at the NAACP mm-hmm. before she delivered the true message. Although, if you look in context, the applause comes specifically after she says that this man was treating her badly, acting superior, and she thought maybe she'd give him a dose of his own medicine, which I wouldn't call that. I wouldn't call that racist exactly. I would call that. Emotional and a reaction that comes in advance of grasping the true meaning of the story. So that's my take. What's yours?
Well, it is true. The Obama administration absolutely panicked when this came out yesterday. Sherrod told the story. She was in rural Georgia, and she was a three-hour drive away from her office. And she's going back, and they're calling her, telling her she needs to resign. And at some point, they call her and tell her she needs to pull over on the side of the road and take care of this. So that tells you they're in full panic mode. NAACP is in panic mode because they have just finished this highly publicized resolution branding some elements of the Tea Party as racist, although we have not seen the actual text of the resolution. It would be easier for me to know what to think about their resolution if I actually saw what it says.
Oh, you're so old-fashioned, Byron.
There you go. But nonetheless, they're very sensitive about that. You know, about it, any appearance of hypocrisy on this. If they're entertaining these kind of statements in their own meetings, and then they're branding the Tea Party as racist. So I think I watched the entire speech, about 45 minutes, last night. And I agree. The first thing is that it doesn't show what it was purported to show. And it was purported to show her behaving in this fashion recently in her job at the USDA. and it was in fact a story that she was telling of an event that happened in 1986. So I don't think that...
And the farmer himself, I think, steps forward to defend her, too. She actually came to be friends with the farmer, and it is actually kind of a moving story that they, you know, they both overcame these divisions of race and connected on a human level.
So she simply should not have been fired for this. Now, it was the story began with, her speech began with a recitation of events from really the 1940s on in South Georgia, and her telling how her father was murdered by white men in 1965, and that were never prosecuted or punished.
So that's the source of her emotional reaction.
And now, I think there's a story in it, and it's not a media story, and it's not her racism story. There were if you were to watch this speech, and there had never been any of this controversy, you know, I was struck by her talking about urging people to get federal jobs because you don't get laid off. You know, there's that part where she says, "You hear all these stories about people being laid off. Have you ever heard about them being laid off by the federal government?" That's all I'm going to say. And then she's basically begging people to come and get federal money. Please, we got all this federal money. We want to give it to you. It was in a very racial context. I mean, she was speaking to the NAACP, and she did use at least one strange term when she talked about referring the white farmer to his own kind, and that he could be taken care of with his own kind, which I think is a term that kind of dates to the separate but equal days, and I think it would seem anachronistic at best to hear anybody use it today.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it an odd and interesting
but consistent
speech.
With her self-portrayal at that part of the story as somebody who was struggling with racial animosity.
Right, and we should point out that this was in the 1980s. It wasn't the 1960s or 50s or 40s or anything. It was something that happened in the 1980s. So, you know, I think that in a fairer world in which the entire tape came out originally, that none of this controversy would have happened, and it could have been the basis for a more interesting story about other things, about the Agriculture Department's programs or about federal bloat, but not what it became.
Now, this is part of, this story surfaced as part of a, this has been kind of a theme, a kind of demonizing theme of conservative media, that the true racists in America are not white people, they are black people. And the other story was about some harassment at a polling place in 2008 by two members of something called the New Black Panther Party, which is actually not the real Black Panther Party. It's some it's a crackpot imitation of a crackpot organization.
Right.
So it's Crackpot Squared. And these two guys were obviously nuts and scary, and they were apparently threatening white people at a polling place who were threatening them not to vote for John McCain. Little mysterious why they chose that particular polling place, because, you know, perhaps there were three people that day at that polling place who voted for John McCain or were going to. It was deep in Obama territory. Just a tactical level, it doesn't seem to have been terribly threatening. But they were basically behaving badly and making a nuisance of themselves, and the cops hauled them off and slapped an injunction on one of them. One of the guys that had a billy club, and they slapped an injunction on him, keeping him away from any polling place in the Philadelphia area until, I think, 2012. This would seem to be a story of not great sort of national significance, but apparently there was some controversy. We don't know how extensive at the in the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department about whether they should have been charged with federal crime. They were not. There is a an ex member of that division who claims that the word went out that you that this that the division may not prosecute black people. It sounds to me wildly implausible that anyone would ever say those words in a government organization. And Megan Fox at Fox News has gone completely gaga over this story, and it's, you know, has been really pushing it hard and giving lots of very sort of, seems to me, bullying interviews with people. I had never seen Megan Fox before. This is my introduction to her. And I
mean,
to
Megan
say,
Kelly,
bit...
I think. Megan
what?
Kelly. I think you're
Megan Kelly. I'm sorry,
Kelly.
Megan Kelly. Megan Fox is a screen siren. Sorry. I'd never seen her before, and I was a little bit shocked. I thought she was behaving badly. And, you know, this is the growing trend in cable news where you're the guest on the show and pretty soon you're starting to wonder, well, what the hell do they even need me for? They won't let me get a word in edgewise. Anyway, so this sort of got whipped into hysteria. It's hard for me to know very much about what's going on because almost everything I have read about this has come from what I deem an untrustworthy source. I do wish that the dread MSM would do a takeout on this, telling us exactly what happened. In some
well, then
detail.
I think that is this. I think you have just hit on the story. My understanding. And I should say right now that I am a Fox News contributor, and I do appear on the network. It seems to me that it became a big story in the conservative world. When the Justice Department, well, when the Justice Department did two things. One, when it decided not to go forward with the case beyond what had been done. And when J. Christian Adams, the former Justice Department official, came out and made these charges, which were supported in some part by other former Justice Department officials who said similar things. And the feeling on the right was... I forget what you referred to Adams as, but most the feeling was that if he were on the left or if he were criticizing the Bush administration, he would be known as a whistleblower, and that he would be exposing or assumed to be exposing wrongdoing inside a politicized Justice Department. And I think that that is the thrust of the coverage that you've seen so far. And I think when you said that you don't trust the news sources you've seen on it, they're and then you said you wish that a news organization that you trusted would do, you know, look into this in some detail. I think that kind of hits it right on the button, that there's this feeling in the conservative world that they're not looking at this in much detail. And if you want to know the story, you can look at the testimony before the Civil Rights Commission. You can look at all the primary sources if you've got the time. But for people who get their news from the New York Times or the Washington Post or the broadcast network news divisions, I wouldn't expect them to do an in-depth story on it, but certainly from the Times and the Post, they haven't seen the story. So I think that the biggest part of this new Black Panther story is not that the new Black Panthers are the most potent force in American politics or that this is the most serious incident that ever occurred at a polling place in America, but that it is serious and that there are legitimate people, Adams, who were in a position to know, who have a version of events about this based on their eyewitness testimony, and that it's not getting covered enough. So I think that is the crux of the issue.
It should. It's become noisy enough. It's become a noisy enough controversy now that there should be a story explaining what really happened. I think it's that very distrust of the sources that have been promoting this, including, I have to say, Fox News, that has probably led a lot of mainstream organizations to write it off. But I think that's the wrong response. The right response is, here are all these conservatives screaming and yelling about this. Let's find out. Let's get to the bottom of what's going on.
Can I jump into what you just said? Because I think what you said is consistent with a theory that I have been throwing around lately. And I want to see what you think about it, which is that the growth and power of Fox News, of the conservative blogosphere, and of conservative talk radio has caused some so-called mainstream media organizations like the Post, like the Times, to actually move a bit to the left. And I mean it in this way, that when a story gets a lot of attention in the Fox conservative talk radio blogosphere world, an Acorn or a New Black Panther or some other story, they see themselves, meaning the journalists of the mainstream, see themselves as providing a counterweight or a counterbalance to that, and they don't investigate the story or report the story on its merits, but rather as a way to provide a counterweight to what they were seeing in this world that John Harris and Mark Halperin called the freak show. And that the White House encourages this, go back to Anita Dunn, by kind of sending the message that Fox is kind of beyond the pale, and that whenever Fox reports a story, it's very important that it not pass into the mainstream, and that it be kept marginalized inside the freak show. And thus, I think that more and more there are reporters who should just be reporters who kind of see themselves as providing the counterbalance to what they see as an extremely powerful right-wing news apparatus.
I would follow the principle of Occam's razor here and say that I would prefer the simpler explanation, which is that Fox News has done very little to acquire much credibility as a news organization, and that it pays the price for that in the response of the mainstream media, which is, if Fox News is flogging something, there's great reluctance to believe that it's true, not because of some concentrated effort to shut Fox News out, but just because it's been led down the garden path by Fox News many times before. And I don't know specifically how they handled this Shirley Sherrod story, for example, but that would be the main villain there, I think, would be Andrew Breitbart. But there is a sense that Fox News and the conservative media generally is given to ratings generating hysteria, and that it does not hew to the same standards that the New York Times and the Washington Post hew to. I have to say, I kind of agree with that.
Well, I have to disagree in the sense that I think there are legitimate stories that do get picked up a lot by Fox and other outlets, including by me in the Washington Examiner, that I find of merit that, you know, I see are ignored. Now, it may just be differing news judgments. For example, the story we had recently of the statements of the NASA administrator who travels to the Middle East to mark the one-year anniversary of President Obama's speech to the Muslim world in June 2009, does an interview with Al Jazeera and says, "When I became the NASA administrator, the president charged me with three things. One was he wanted me to help re-inspire children to want to get into science and math. He wanted me to expand our international relationships. And third, and perhaps foremost, he wanted me to find a way to reach out to the Muslim world and engage much more with dominantly Muslim nations to help them feel good about their historic contribution to science, math, and engineering." And I found that an interesting story worth pursuing and reporting. And I think, and it was reported on Fox News, I think, to some extent. And it just didn't make it into the Times, didn't make it into the Post. And my guess is, and this is a guess, that they saw it, they saw that the freak show was getting all excited about it, and they didn't want to have anything to do with it.
It's, I mean, I have to say, you know, my initial reaction to that story when I saw it, and I did read it in, I think, the Post did something, didn't they?
No, I think they did a brief blog item. I mean, really brief blog item.
Oh, did they? Well, you know, my reaction to it was, oh, come on, the president, this is a telephone game here. The president did not actually say to the NASA administrator, your most important task is to make the Islamic world feel good about its historic contribution to science and math. I can see that being mentioned, you know, as part of a larger conversation, as sort of one of the things he should try and do, or maybe one of the things that they were trying to do in several agencies. But it is so obviously not the main job of the NASA administrator to do that I can't believe that an intelligent man like President Barack Obama would say that. And I think I seem to recall that the White House did deny. They said, you know, they said, look, this is a talking point that we've been that we gave to a number of cabinet officials, but no, this is not the obviously.
It was several days after the story had happened, and it's still not been reported, I think, in the Post or the Times. And I didn't do a Nexus search before this, but I believe it may still not have been reported by them. But anyway, a reporter at the briefing, I think it was Ed Henry of CNN, not sure, but I think it was Ed Henry, asked about this, and Gibbs, Robert Gibbs, the spokesman, had a prepared answer. Obviously, he'd been waiting for the question, mm-hmm. which had not come for days, and said no, that this didn't happen. And then, so I went back to NASA and said, well, is Gibbs right? And NASA has been very, at least the spokesman, has been very, what's the word to say? They haven't said that Gibbs is wrong, but they haven't said that Bolden was wrong either.
I just can't say I'm not terribly shocked. So the president told one of his cabinet officials, actually, NASA minister is not a cabinet.
So now you have a conflict between the White House and the head of an agency over this issue, and it's still not newsworthy because you just can't believe it's really a story. So I think that's just different.
Is it a scandal that the president told the head of NASA to be nice to Muslims?
I don't know that it's a scandal. Something can be news without being a scandal, can it?
Is it even of interest that the president told the head of NASA to be nice to Muslims? I think a news story, the way I was trained, a news story would be the president telling the head of NASA to be mean to Muslims. Now, that's a story.
I found it of interest that the NASA administrator, even if he misspoke, said that perhaps the foremost mission to him given by the president was to reach out to Muslim nations and make them feel good about their accomplishments in math and science. I found that interesting and newsworthy that the head of NASA would say that in an interview, by the way, with Al Jazeera. And also, by the way, he did say that, I think it was on June 28th, when Bolden called some of the oversight committees, the chairman and ranking members of oversight committees on Congress, because Obama was rolling out a new space policy. And he also mentioned the Muslim outreach to them at that time. Some of them were quite surprised to hear it, and he had told Al Jazeera 11 days earlier. So I found all of that to be newsworthy. Here again, I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, a headline that stretches across the fold, above the fold, but nonetheless, newsworthy.
I have to say I can't. I have not read your coverage specifically, but based on your description, I do not find it that a riveting story. Now, I do find the Shirley Sherrod story, as misreported, riveting, but then it turned out to be misleading. Now, the other hot conservative story of the moment on the Daily Caller is Journolist.
Right.
The Daily Caller is running a series on embarrassing, stupid things that left-leaning journalists on Journolist said to each other. Journolist was a group of liberal and left journalists and some academics and activists talking to each other in a closed environment. It was all off the record, supposedly, and It was run by Ezra Klein at the Washington Post, and some intemperate comments by David Weigel, who covered the conservative movement, got him fired at the Post, even though I think he said them before he came to work at the Post, but even so, he was seen as having a kind of unacceptable bias. My feeling about this is, I think I think it's all part of the same story that people join it. I was actually invited at one point to join this thing, and I said no because I just sort of didn't like the sound of it. It sounded very clubby, and it sounded very smug, and this Daily Caller series does appear to confirm that. This is, a bunch of, many of them actually pretty good journalists, but they're all sort of mouthing off at each other in infantile ways and saying stupid, angry, sort of spouting angry things about conservatives, about the dominance of the Jeremiah Wright theme at one point in the presidential race in 2008, and there were some loose talk about trying to suppress it. The one point that I think has not been made clearly enough is that this was not the dread mainstream media. This was a bunch of liberal and actually mostly left journalists kind of egging each other on saying excitable,
well,
stupid
things.
Well,
this is a question I have for you.
Only a few degrees, I think only a few degrees more obnoxious than what I frequently see on the National Review's public version of this, which is called...
Well, I think
Corner,
public makes a lot of difference.
I
think public
Pardon
makes
me?
A lot of difference, right?
Well, now it's public.
No, it's not. This went on for 2 or 3 years. Presumably there are thousands and thousands of entries that we haven't seen. We've just seen
right.
a small bit.
Right. Right. The fact that it was private made it slightly more insular and
now,
stupid. I think the larger lesson is when people who agree with each other talk to each other at great length, they start saying really idiotic and sometimes offensive.
Well,
things.
I think your instinct when you were asked to join was probably telling and correct. One thing I don't know is that the intemperate things that we've seen quoted in the Daily Caller have not come from the Washington Post or the New York Times or the broadcast networks. The most intemperate thing came from Spencer Ackerman, who I think works for Wired, had been at the New Republic at one time. I don't know his whole history. And this was during the Reverend Wright controversy in the 08 campaign, and he said basically to push back, the left needed to just select a journalist, any journalist, Fred Barnes, anybody on the right, Fred Barnes or Karl Rove, who you wouldn't call a journalist, and just accuse them of racism, because it was important to show the right that there would be a price to pay for attacking the left, and what you need to do is you need to take somebody and throw them through a plate glass window and then take a picture of the bloody mess and send it to everyone and show them that this is what happens if they do that.
It was a stupid and offensive suggestion, one that nobody, including Ackerman himself, followed through on. And like I say,
people on the right do believe that they have been accused of racism on a number of occasions, maybe not Fred Barnes or Karl Rove specifically, but they think that it's a tactic that has been employed quite a bit.
There's sort of two separate questions here. One was this particular threat acted upon?
Correct, that particular
no.
one.
The other question is, do conservatives occasionally get accused of racism? The answer is yes. I guess the third question would be, have conservatives at times been guilty of racism? Yes, there have been instances where conservatives were guilty
of
racism.
Here's my bigger question to you about this. These intemperate comments, and there's one today by a woman from NPR, a producer who says that she would seems to want to see Rush Limbaugh lying on the ground, dying of a heart attack with his eyes bugging out. But these have come. Now, that's from NPR. Ackerman, here again, is not at the Post of the Times. And the other statements were from people at The Nation and elsewhere, although in the news story there are people from NPR and Bloomberg just talking. Question is, if you have, let's say there really are a number of intemperate statements in journalists made by people like Ackerman, should people, should mainstream reporters at the Washington Post and at the New York Times be on this journalist and be part of the conversation, even if they're not contributing the kind of inflammatory stuff that makes news later? But is this something they should be doing?
You could make an argument that if you were a if your main impulse is to be a journalist as opposed to being a manipulator or a propagandist, and I think your main impulse can be a journalist. Your main impulse can focus on journalism even if you are an opinion journalist. I don't distinguish so much between opinion journalists and objective journalists as I do between independent journalists and hacks. But if you want to be an independent journalist, I suppose an argument could be made that there would be some value in lurking on this journalist and just sort of mm-hmm. seeing what people are saying, just to inform yourself of the more extreme sort of parts of the conversation that are mm-hmm. conducted in private. Participating in it, I think, is a bad idea, because I think any kind of journalist, no matter whether he's an opinion journalist or an objective journalist, is really best off talking to people with whom he disagrees rather than people with whom he agrees. Mm-hmm. And most of all, he's best off talking not to people who have opinions about a particular matter, but those who actually know what's going on. Mm-hmm. A radical thought in this day and age. But, you know, journalists talking to journalists in general is not a particularly good journalism technique.
Do you think that... wait a minute. The thought just blew out of my mind, and it was such a penetrating question. on the privacy issue, we have heard some kind of offended, hurt comments from participants and journalists saying this is off the record and that should be protected. And do you think the so-called off-the-recordness of journalists is on a par with an off-the-record agreement that a journalist makes with a newsmaker? Are they on a par in your mind?
If they are on a par, it's that both are of limited value, and both agreements can be violated without the perpetrator ever being found. So, on a practical matter,
this is off the record unless you say something really, really interesting.
Right, which is actually the way the rule usually works. I've actually written a lot about how I think that sort of journalism ground rules are the weight of them is vastly overstated. But look, it is true whether you're a government official or a journalist, you shouldn't go around saying things, and particularly committing things to writing that you'd be sorry to see in the public prints. It's and just as a human being, it's just not a good idea to go around saying stupid stuff. You know, when you open your mouth, you want to contribute to the sum of human knowledge, not subtract from it. So I don't feel sorry for any of the people who got caught out in this. I could have told you at the outset that once a certain number of fairly prominent people were known to participate in this, and there were a few. Paul Krugman, I think, mm-hmm. was involved at one point, and Joe Klein, and once you got people like that involved, there's no way it's going to stay private. Right. It just isn't. And no matter what the agreement is, somebody's going to leak it. And so you're a fool if you think otherwise.
Okay. So, and you don't think it's just a bad thing, if not the most important thing in the world, but it's not a bad thing that it's coming out now, right?
But Mickey Cass, actually, my colleague at Slate, published some leaked stuff from a journalist a year or two ago. And I certainly didn't object to that either. I mean, I think look, you're a journalist. When you're a journalist, your job is to tell people stuff. It's not Mickey's job to enforce the confidentiality agreement among a bunch of other people. Somebody, a journalist, leaked stuff to Mickey. Somebody, a journalist, leaked stuff to the Daily Caller. Should that person burn in hell? No, I don't think so. I mean, they violated an essentially unenforceable agreement. And it certainly wasn't, you know, a matter of national security. I don't, as a general rule, like going after leakers anyway. That's what I think.
By the way, is Mickey coming back to Slate?
He is pondering his options at the moment. I hope he does. I disagree with Mickey a lot, but I think he's a completely brilliant guy and fun to read, and I've been a fan of his and friend of his for many years, and I very much hope he comes back.
I do too. I'm a huge fan of Kaus Files, and I hope that it's back. So this has been kind of the special all journalism edition until now, but I guess we could talk about actual news.
The real world.
Yeah, there's a possibility.
Oh, if we must.
All right. Well, this unemployment thing has been this unemployment benefits thing has been interesting. Finally passed by the Senate on a 60-40 vote, in which I think the Democrats lost Ben Nelson and got Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe for their 60 votes. And also the new senator from West Virginia got to vote. And it seems to me what was interesting, if you listen to the White House briefing...
Scott Brown voted against.
Yeah, I think all the Republicans except for Snowe and Collins voted against.
That's remarkable that a senator from Massachusetts would vote against extending...
Well, you know, I think the Republicans have an entirely reasonable position on this, which is to say that they're for this. They would just want to use currently uncommitted stimulus funds to do it. It's about $35 billion, I think, and use uncommitted stimulus funds to pay for this and not poke yet another hole in the PAYGO rules. And the Democrats are saying, no, this is emergency spending, and it is not subject to the PAYGO rules that we passed. And one thing, to get back to the press, at the White House briefing, I guess it was on Monday or maybe Tuesday, they blend together, Gibbs was asked a lot of questions about this. Well, what would be wrong with just using the stimulus money? Is it that crazy to just use the stimulus money because it's not committed right now? There's a whole ton of it. And would it be crazy to do this? And he kept saying, well, the Republicans were not operating in good faith, and this was an emergency, and it was wrong. So this strikes me as it's clearly election year positioning on the deficit issue, in which Republicans are trying to make the argument that they are in favor of extending these benefits and have a perfectly reasonable plan to extend them, which is true. Vote against this bill.
But what hurt them is that a member of the Senate leadership gave a speech saying that it's a bad idea to extend unemployment benefits because you're just going to discourage people from.
Now, that's another question I was going to, and perhaps you've looked into this more than I have, but we're talking about extending unemployment benefits to 99 weeks in some cases. And perhaps it's not impossible to foresee efforts to extend them beyond 99 weeks at some point. So that raises two questions. One, at some point, does unemployment become the dole? And two, is there anything to this idea that extending unemployment benefits extends the length of time that people are unemployed? That is, when their unemployment benefits are when the end date, the expiration date is approaching, that people tend to step up their job searching activities, and more of them tend to get jobs in that last period when they know their benefits are going to expire. Is there anything to those two issued questions?
I have given this, I can't say I've given this an extensive look. I have given this a non-extensive look. And based on what I have seen, the findings are this. There is, yes, it has been shown that giving unemployment benefits, is a small disincentive to looking for work. I think the finding is that if you extend it unemployment for what is something like 13 weeks, you may be extending somebody's spell of unemployment by 1 week. What I think that shows is that it is a minor factor. It is an inevitable factor that, you give people money to live on, that they are less desperate. Apparently it is not, they're not a lot less desperate. It really stinks to be unemployed anyway. And mostly, they are looking for a job. There have been a few outlier studies that have been cited by, Amity Schles and a couple of other people that showed a more pronounced effect. But again, based on my kind of cursory reading on this, those studies were not consistent with most of the research on this, which has found a real but small effect.
Well, let's say there is that real but small effect. Should that affect the thinking of members of Congress as they vote on extending unemployment benefits?
No, it should not, because the good that is done by extending unemployment benefits overwhelms that small harmful effect. The good being, first of all, it's a significant stimulus to spending. Unemployed people are taking the money and they are actually using it to spend. And also, I think just a kind of basic decency. People are out of work. The economy is hurting. The main reason people are not employed is because employers aren't hiring. And that being the case, it's
well,
brutal.
In that case, do you think there's
insurance? And this is something completely a government handout. People, it's a form of social insurance. People pay, into a fund to cover the possibility of unemployment, and apparently it's unprecedented. You know, you or at least in recent times for Republicans to block unemployment in a time of recession. I think Republicans have played this very poorly politically. I think it's going to hurt them. I do not think that you are going to see a lot of political independents saying, good on those Republicans. They wouldn't extend unemployment benefits when unemployment.
Do you think there should be a time limit on unemployment benefits?
I think there should be a time limit on recessions.
Well, the government can control
one. I think
one
that
and
this
not
is an unusually right. This is an unusually long recession. And as long as it persists, I think that, extraordinary measures need to be taken. I hope to God we're out of it soon. There's all sorts of scary economic news out there. The Wall Street Journal today has a story saying that the housing market is in slightly worse shape than we thought. And it's, conceivable that the housing market will drag us down again into a double-dip recession. I want this recession to be over. I think the government should be doing everything it can to stimulate spending and to help people get through it. I've written that I would like to have seen the government spend much more money on much more directly on giving people jobs, including government jobs if need be. I am very worried, actually, that, I joined Paul Krugman in this. I'm very, very worried that the long-term concern about deficit spending will get in the way of the short-term need for deficit spending. You can't worry about the deficit right now. There should be long-term solutions under consideration because, obviously, it would be disastrous to keep spending at this level for an extended period of time, but we need to get out of this recession.
Well, my feeling is Republicans are correct on the issue of how to pay for this extension, which they support, but they are probably going to get kicked pretty badly politically because they did vote against the bill. And when you're in a position of explaining your motive, which is, oh, there was money in the stimulus, we could have used that to spend for it, but they wanted to add to the debt. You know, when you're explaining like that in a political campaign, you're often losing. So,
and Kyle's speech, you know, sort of nicks that argument because it allows Democrats to say, look, they just don't want to extend unemployment benefits, period.
Well, I do think, I would be interested to know the public opinion on this issue of whether extending benefits tends to extend the period of time unemployment. I think, you know, most people...
But there should be a follow-up question that says, do you care? If it does, do you care?
Well, I mean, a lot of people are either out of jobs or scared of losing. If you took the number of people who are scared of losing their jobs and added it to the unemployment rate, it would be a huge number. I mean, so the question is how this would affect...
Yeah, I followed the hearings a bit, and I really thought that the sort of conservative onslaught against Kagan, such as it was kind of half-hearted.
A half-hearted onslaught.
It felt obligatory rather than heartfelt. That it was stupid. I mean, you know, sort of Kagan was getting beaten up for saying that it's okay for the courts to consider foreign law on occasion. Things like that. There just didn't seem to be a lot of intelligent criticism of Kagan. I thought it was fairly. She did a great job in her hearings, but I attribute at least 60% of that to the fact that the questions she got asked, the tough ones, tended to be pretty idiotic. One point was that Tom Coburn got into a whole thing. He got into a swivet because they teach constitutional law the second year at Harvard Law School rather than the first year. I thought, really, is this the best he can do? Really? And yet Coburn, of course, not only voted against her, but didn't show up. He voted by proxy, as did, I think, a couple of other
on both sides, they voted by proxy.
Were there on both sides?
Yeah. There were some proxies.
Dana Milbank made an issue of this in a column today. Perhaps he was being out there. But, I think that I think it is hard to articulate a conservative case against Kagan. She's not especially liberal. She was the most conservative of all the people under consideration. It's on a game theory basis. It's not especially smart for Republicans to vote uniformly against Kagan, because it does tend to foster the thinking, well, shoot, if they're going to act this way when we put forth a centrist candidate, let's have a little fun and put forth a more liberal candidate. After all, they're you know, same outcome, so what's the difference?
Well, I had actually thought that this was Obama's opportunity, and perhaps his only opportunity, to go way left on a nominee, which he could have done, and that nominee would be moving toward confirmation right now because he's got 59 votes in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's going to have 59 votes in the Senate next year, but this would have been the time.
Well, this is Obama's brand of bipartisanship. He's constantly making, unilateral concessions to the other side that the other side ignores.
Well, see, that depends on your characterization of Kagan as a centrist, and I really don't know. My feeling is that she's probably going to be a reliable liberal vote on the court, and I would be very surprised if she's anything different than that. I do think Republicans had good and telling but non-disqualifying interest to talk about with her. The whole ROTC thing, I thought Jeff Sessions looked into that at some length. For me, I thought her actions in the whole partial birth abortion issue in the Clinton White House in 1996 were just appalling. I mean,
That was the best thing they had.
And Republicans didn't really feature that a lot. They didn't do it till the second day, and still didn't just you know, beat on it relentlessly, but it was a remarkable story. And you know, so, but they didn't.
Do you think it was disqualifying?
Well, you have to remember it in the current context, in which did four Democrats vote for Alito? Am I right on that?
I can't remember.
Was it eight for anyway? No, maybe it was eight for Alito and then four Republicans for Sotomayor. I mean, we're way down. We're down to the point where a handful of the opposition party votes for the president's a nominee of the opposition party, and so in that context, yeah. But there is a continuing debate among Republicans about this, the old-fashioned idea of whether, when the president sends a qualified nominee to the court, whether that nominee deserves confirmation. There are some Republicans who still believe that, Lindsey Graham being one, and you'll see a few more others in the final vote. And then there are some Republicans who have given more to the strategic point of view, especially after the filibuster battles of 2002 and 2003. So it's an extremely bitter and contentious.
So I would call that right tactical now, rather than strategic, because it seems to me long-term strategy is that you reward the opposition for concessions in order to encourage them to make concessions in the future. Although I'll grant you, in Obama's case, he continues to grant the concessions anyway, but there surely is some point at which.
Well, look, Bush. You know, when Bush first took office in 2001, he renominated two Clinton nominees, one of whom was Roger Gregory to the Fourth Circuit, and the other I can't remember, who had been, in the eyes of Democrats, unfairly held up by Republicans in the during the Clinton years. So Bush, as a goodwill gesture, renominated these nominees.
There was a lot of good bipartisanship from Bush at the beginning. So.
And in your scenario, this would encourage cooperation on the part of Democrats in the Senate, and it didn't. They took over the Senate, you know, with the defection of Senator Jeffords early in the Bush years, early in 2001 in the administration. And then they immediately, of course, confirmed the two Clinton nominees that Bush renominated and proceeded to block a large number of Bush circuit court nominees, ultimately resulting in the filibuster fights after the Republicans retook the Senate in 2002.
But the resolution of that was a kind of an agreement to cooperate, at least to some extent.
Well, the resolution was Bill Frist wielded the what was called at that time the nuclear option,
right,
in a believable enough way so that Democrats caved and gave Bush almost all the nominees that they were holding up.
Right, I didn't say the Democrats compromised to be nice. I said the Democrats, what I meant to say was the Democrats compromised because it was in their strategic interest.
Right, because they didn't want, they thought that Frist was going to go ahead and actually kill the judicial filibuster, and everybody would have been in completely unknown territory at that
point. In that instance, yeah, the carrot didn't work, the stick worked.
Yeah, absolutely. So will Lindsey Graham get challenged? I'll say one thing. I was down covering, I guess it was McCain in South Carolina. Graham, of course, is always with McCain in the campaign of 2007 and 2008. And one time, Graham made these slight self-effacing remarks, and he said, "Well, down here we elect senators for 50 years. Thanks for the job." Referring to Strom Thurmond and Ernest Hollings, and you talk about rankling conservatives saying, "Lindsey, it doesn't have to be for 50 years."
Right.
But so far, he has not had a credible, well-financed, you know, real killer primary challenge. Hadn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. Could emerge. We don't know. I think that the I guess my parting thought would be that I think that the it goes against the grain. I think that the level of partisan fervor cannot sustain itself over the long term. I think we're seeing a high watermark here, and that it will recede. I think that there's a point at which partisan behavior really starts to hurt you. And I think the Republicans have reached it. I do think they will pick up seats in the fall. I don't think they're going to get the House. And I think that they are going to be very disappointed overall with the gains that they achieve. And that there will be... I also think that the Tea Party movement is... the Tea Party movement is exactly the sort of movement that never, ever, ever sustains itself in American politics, because when you get a lot of cranky libertarians together, they cannot stay cohesive for very long because they're cranky libertarians. You saw this in the Ross Perot following, which was much more moderate than the Tea Party movement, but it had some of the same characteristics. All these people drawn to Ross Perot because they kind of fancied themselves sort of mini Ross Perots. And Ross Perot was a difficult and cantankerous person who couldn't get along with anybody, and so were all of his followers. And I think we will soon see the same within the Tea Party movement. I also expect any day now to see somebody writing a piece saying the Tea Party movement was blown way out of proportion to its actual size. Either that or that it collapsed suddenly. It's starting to feel a little bit like it's been overblown. And whether the fault lies with people reporting on it or whether it's just the inherent instability of the Tea Party movement, I don't think a year from now we'll be talking about the Tea Party. We'll be talking about something else.
Well, as an actual organization, it has been overblown quite a bit. As a as a state of mind, I don't think it's been overblown. And whether I'm right or you're right on that will be shown in November. We'll have to revisit our predictions. My feeling is that for all of the anger you hear at Tea Party rallies directed toward Republicans, and the basic story is that Bush and Republicans couldn't control spending and they opened the door with TARP and other things for Obama to walk in and blow the budget in historic ways. That's their complaint. For all their complaints about Republicans, most of them are going to vote for the Republican candidate this time around.
Right, but I think that's the wrong tack to take. I mean, Dave Weigel did a piece like this for Slate that I disagreed with, too. It imagines that the argument that the Tea Party hurts Republicans is based on the idea that the Tea Party is going to challenge Republican candidates. And I think that's not the way the Tea Party hurts Republicans. The Tea Party hurts Republicans by scaring Republicans into taking more extreme positions. It's when the Tea Party is appeased by Republicans that the Republicans create danger for themselves. That's my opinion. But
we'll see on that one. I don't think this has happened before. We are now over 1 hour, which is a lot of time. Is there anything else to cover?
No, I don't think so. It's been fun talking to you, and till next time.
I have enjoyed it, and until next time, we'll see you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.